Just a request, inshallah, if we can, some of the older youth, if you guys can take more control of this program that we have, English speeches, inshallah, we can have at least in the beginning, after Quran, we can have a small speech by some of the younger youth, and then we can start our main lecture, inshallah. There seems to be no control or nobody in charge right now of the youth programs here in English. Inshallah, that will change, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Fatiha, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Maliki yawmiddin, ya na'amun, ya fasl. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
وعلى أهل البيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين ولعن الله أعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم كل من عليه فان ويبقى وجه ربك ذو الجلال والإكرام صلوا على محمد وعلى محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد.
This is our second lecture in our 5-lecture series. I'm here, inshallah, until Tuesday with all of you. Yesterday we began a topic that I'd like to recap from yesterday. There are several new faces. And for those who were here yesterday, my apologies for the repeats, but just so we're on the same page moving forward, we began to talk a little bit about this absurd debate that's going on nowadays about Islam versus modernism, where those quote-unquote modernists believe that Islam needs to reform itself to fit the times, where Islam is prehistoric, outdated, perhaps it was made just for the Holy Prophet's time. And so what I mentioned yesterday was that it felt like, or it seemed like, and perhaps I'm wrong, that there was this two groups of people, or two groups within Islam, two divisions practically I mentioned yesterday. One was pre-9/11, one was post-9/11. And how Islam was practiced one way pre-9/11 for 1,422 years. Come 9/11, in the past 10 years now, those basic fundamental essences that make up this religion of ours are now being challenged all of a sudden because 9/11 happened. As if to say that these past 10 years that 9/11 happened, everything that was practiced before 9/11 now has to be questioned and reviewed and looked at. And I gave some examples of some of the individuals that are within the Islamic faith, unfortunately, who come out and challenge our Islamic doctrine. And that's why we've labeled these lectures the internal battle of Islam, because the battle, unfortunately, is within. We have individuals like Irshad Manji, as I mentioned yesterday, like Dr. Ashraf Izzat, who writes an article about challenging the system of hijab, saying that it was a command that only came about during the Prophet's time to make Muslim sisters distinct from the Jewish and the Christian women. It had nothing to do with modesty and humility and humbleness. In fact, he says the hijab today is not a covering of the hair, it's a covering of the mind, unfortunately. And so he has this picture of a woman, a sister who is wearing proper hijab, and the caption reads, "Why would any woman want to cover herself this way?" And see, I mean, these are the type of things that right now exist, and these are just two examples I mentioned yesterday. And this is an Egyptian doctor who is also a Muslim, quote-unquote. And of course we have Irshad Manji, who I mentioned yesterday, was an individual who was a practicing Muslim, supposedly, in Vancouver. And she relays this story on her blog about her being 14 and challenging her Sunday school teacher. He couldn't answer the question, so she decided to reform the religion. So she writes a book called The Trouble with Islam. And she's touring the world, and she's talking about feminism, and she's talking about the courage to change the religion. And, you know, this is a woman, as I mentioned yesterday, who has the practices and lives a lifestyle of the Qawmi Lut. And this is the voice right now of Islam in the West, and she has a huge following, unfortunately. And this is what we're dealing with. And our youth, unfortunately, some of them at least, are buying it. They think that, yeah, they're right, Islam is outdated, that hijab was maybe years ago something that was wajib, but today in 2011, in the West especially, it seems to be a setback for us. We don't get the jobs that we need. We don't get the husbands that we desire. We don't get the respect that we need in society. And so what ends up happening is that we believe that Islam is not modern. Islam is outdated. Islam needs to change, na'udhu billah, to fit today's time. So that was our discussion yesterday. That'll be our topic for the next few days. We'll look at several various factors in this absurd discussion. And the only reason why I bring this up with all of you is because it's a reality. And as one youth said last night to me, very wisely, he says that, you know, I said, bhai, it's a good topic, but you're preaching to the choir. Right? And he's right. A lot of what we discuss up here are made for those who are not here. And so, with all of you being here, I know that some of you, inshallah, will get the point. Thank you. But the point is, and I mentioned to this brother yesterday, was that if ever you find yourself in a debate, discussion about this topic, inshallah, you'll have the weaponry in your pocket to be able to defend yourself. And maybe inside the minds and the hearts of some of you, you have these questions but don't have the courage to ask them. And so this idea of debating with your fellow brother and sister, I would recommend it. In fact, the Quran talks about this idea of udu'u ila sabili rabbika bil hikmati wal maw'idati al hasana wajadilhum billati hiya ahsan. Very beautifully he says that call people towards the path of your Lord, but do it with wisdom and good arguments. And battle them, debate them, sit down, discuss with them. But do it with ahsan, do it with good nature. There's no reason to get emotional, get excited. Right? Do it with the idea of you passing forward your wisdom. And to understand this is a small story that I often tell many individuals in different communities. I want to share it here because it fits in our topic. To allow you to understand the way that our Ahlul Bayt used to discuss things with individuals. You know that our fifth and sixth Imam, they had an open door policy of questions. They never turned anybody away. Atheists, Muslims, non-Shias, Shias, everybody and anybody would come to the door of these two imams and ask them all sorts of questions. Questions that you and I would get upset at if, God forbid, somebody was to come to us and ask us these questions. Our reaction would be something else. When someone's coming to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, and he says that, I'm a God just like the God that you believe in. And Imam Sadiq says, really? He says, explain further. He says, well, I create just like your God creates. He said, okay, what can you create? He said, well, if you give me some garbage and a little bit of moisture, I'll create worms for you. He said, okay, show me. So he collects a little bit of garbage, a little bit of moisture, and lo and behold, 5 minutes later, there are a bunch of worms that are going here, there. And Imam Sadiq says, of course, I'm paraphrasing, he says, not bad. He says, tell me, as the creator of these worms, tell me which ones of these worms are male and which ones are female. He says, I have no idea. He says, tell me at least the weights of your creation. Can you tell me the weight of the creation? He says, I have no idea. He goes, fine. The worms are going all over the place. He goes, command them as the creator of these worms to go one way, all of them. He can't do it. Look at the approach, though, of the Ahlul Bayt. If somebody had approached us and said, I'm a God, just like the God that you believe in, what would be our reaction? Right? So the approachability. And in this day and age, when all these topics are hot, and a lot of you guys in school and in work are being approached by individuals who either want to know about Islam or want to challenge you about your belief. You'll meet all kinds of people out there. But it has to be bil hikmati. It has to be with wisdom. There's a commentary of the Quran by Abu Yazdi, a very famous one. I think it's here as well. I saw it. It's a very thick Quran with very thin paper. It's not a tafsir, I wouldn't say. It's a commentary. It's a shadow of the Quran. And the last ayat of Surah Takathur, ثُمَّ لَا تُسْعَلُونَ يَوْمَ عِذِنَ عَنِ النَّعِيمِ, that soon, that on the day of judgment, you'll be asked about your blessings. You'll be asked about your na'im, your blessings. Aghapuya in this ayat relates another incident from the life of our sixth Imam, where this very famous conversation between Abu Hanifa and Imam Sadiq takes place. Again, we're talking about what? Bil hikmati, keep that in mind. So Abu Hanifa approaches Imam Sadiq and says, Ya Rasulullah, the people of Kufa are in dire need of your supports. Either you go yourself and guide them, or at least send your companion, somebody. He says, Abu Hanifa, they won't listen to me, no matter how much I guide them. He says, how is that possible? You are from the lineage of the Prophet of Allah. You're the Ahlul Bayt. How can they not listen to you? He says, Nu'man, that was his real name. He says, Nu'man, the same way you don't listen to me, it's the same way that he won't listen, that they won't listen to me. And then Imam Sadiq challenges Abu Hanifa and says, I understand that you do qiyas when it comes to the extracting of fiqhi rulings. What is qiyas? Qiyas is analogical reasoning, using analogies to come to some sort of conclusion. And while Islam accepts that type of reasoning, we don't accept it when it comes to deriving Islamic rulings. In the Shia school of thought, we have Quran, Sunnah, Aql. In the Sunni school of thought, they have Quran, Sunnah, Qiyas. For us, when it comes to fiqh rulings, it's haram. The example that's often given in books about what qiyas is, just so you understand, is that you have the first sentence that says that red wine is haram. The second sentence is that watermelon juice is red. And the natija, the conclusion is thus watermelon juice is haram. Right? That's a very low level example, but you can see that you have a first sentence, what's called sughra, kubra, natija, as they say in philosophy. This type of reasoning to extract Allah's rulings is haram for us as Shias. Abu Hanifa was the father of this school of thought. So Imam Sadiq says, Abu Hanifa, I understand you do qiyas when it comes to fiqhi rulings. He says, yes, Ibn Abdullah, when I don't understand the ruling, when it's not apparent in Quran and Sunnah, I do qiyas. Now you would think that maybe, you know, he'll say, stop doing it. What are you doing? Are you ignorant? No. The approach of Imam Sadiq. He says, tell me, Abu Hanifa, which one in your eyes is a greater sin? Is it murder or adultery? He said, it's murder, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, for sure. He said, tell me if your qiyas can answer this question, and if murder is the greater sin in Islam, why do you need two witnesses for murder, but four for adultery? No answer. He says, tell me which one is more of a acceptable worship in the eyes of Allah? Which one is greater in the eyes of Allah? Is it salat or saum? Is it prayers or fasting? He said, well, it's prayers, for sure, Ya Rasulullah. He goes, and tell me, again, according to your qiyas, that when a woman is not able to fast or pray, Allah says to make up the fast, but not the prayer. Does your qiyas answer that question? No answer. He goes on. He says, tell me which one is more najis in your eyes, semen or urine? He says, urine is more najis. Then tell me, Nu'man, that when urine exits the body, one wudu and you're able to go back to taharat, but with semen, the entire body has to be washed, and then you go back to taharat. Does your qiyas answer this question? He says no. He then says that, Nu'man, mashallah, I understand that not only do you derive fiqhi rulings using qiyas, but you do tafsir of the Qur'an as well with qiyas. He said, yes, I do. He said, mashallah. So this ayat now he asks, ثُمَّ لَا تُسْعَلُونَ يَوْمَ عِذٍ عَنِ النَّعِيمِ, that soon you'll be asked on the Day of Judgment about these blessings. He goes, tell me, Abu Hanifa, what are these blessings that Allah is referring to? Is it food, shelter, water, clothing? He said, yes, according to my research, Allah will ask us about these blessings. He said, okay, Abu Hanifa, tell me now, for example, if somebody was to invite you to their house for dinner, give you a nice dinner, give you some water. In fact, if it gets too late, they'll even offer to stay. Come stay at our place. And you'll stay there, you'll have breakfast in the morning, you'll leave. On your way out, after feeding you and giving you water and giving you shelter, etc., this host of yours says, Norman, you ate at my place, you drank at my place, I gave you shelter, I gave you a bed, everything. But rest assured, I'm going to call you out one day about this, Dawat. I'm going to get mine back from you. What would you think of this person? Oh, I think you'd be a bakhil, kanjus, a tight person. You invite me to your house and you ask me about all these things? He said, then why do you have the same thoughts about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? That Allah gives you food and shelter and water, and then He has the gall to ask you about them? At that moment, Abu Hanifa says, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, you tell me about this ayat. He says, this ayat, that is the na'im in this ayat, refers to three things, Abu Hanifa. One is submission to Allah, second is obedience to the Prophet, and third is the love of the Ahlul Bayt. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And the point of narrating this hadith for you is to understand that when you do come across those individuals who do ask you whether or not Islam is modern, outdated, prehistoric, etc., you have to have hikmat and wisdom in your argument. No one's going to listen to a person who keeps raising his voice. And so when we talk about this idea of Islam versus modernism, the problem that we have as Islamists, as they call us, is that the criteria for modern thinking for us is a little bit confusing. As I mentioned last night, what is modern today wasn't modern 10 years ago. And what is modern today won't be modern 20 years from now. So relativeness tells us that when you talk about the modernness of the world, thoughts and acts and culture, it's very relative. Again, what's modern in the US is not modern in India. What's modern in Australia is not modern in Canada. So there's no absolute modernness, as they say. And that's one of the biggest flaws that researchers talk about when it comes to this modern thinking. It's not absolute. It's relative across every nation, across every culture. And so when you bring that to the table and attempt to debate Islam with it, it becomes a very absurd debate. Islam was brought down for the masses, for every single human being. It wasn't brought down for just the Arabs. It wasn't brought down just for the Meccans. It wasn't brought down for just those who existed around the Prophet of Allah. So the first discussion that has to happen tonight is the universality of Islam. We claim Islam to be universal. Islam doesn't look at color or nationality or language or country. Islam looks at taqwa and piety alone. And how do we prove that? Look, when you look at proving something in Islam, you look at two aspects, aqli and naqli. Using your aql, of course, your intellect, and using naql, narrations and traditions. When it comes to both aspects, again, we have proof about the universality of the religion of Islam. Aqli, we look at history, we look at the Prophet of Allah. After the conquests of the Arabian Peninsula, he did what? He sent out letters to Iran, to Rome, to Egypt, to Abyssinia, inviting people to Islam. He sent several letters and sent several ambassadors. And he did this with the hopes that they would accept Islam. So right away, that one small act by Rasulullah is teaching us that he wanted to spread Islam to the masses. There's no other reason why you would write so many letters. There's no other reason why you would invite these world leaders towards Islam who already had their religion intact. The only purpose was to do what? Was to make Islam universal across the board. Our logic dictates that this was the reason why our Prophet did this act. The second naqli proof that we have about the universality of Islam, if you open the Quran and you understand that the Quran talks to several different people in different ayats. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Can I ask some of my youth to just come off the walls here and come to the front here, put your cell phones away from me, please? Unless you're taking notes on your cell phone, that's a different story. It's possible. Please. And you know, the beauty of three languages having parallel programs, you have your choice. If you don't want to be here, please feel free to pick Arabic or pick Farsi or pick Urdu. There are more qualified individuals speaking outside of this room. So if you don't want to be here, please, by all means, there's tea in the front and the weather is beautiful. No one's forcing to be here, please. Thank you. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Where was I? Yeah, no, thanks, Zaki, thanks. Some questions are not meant to be answered. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Talking about the universality of the religion. The Quran talks about and addresses several different people in the Quran. If you open the Quran and read it, inshallah, someday, one day, inshallah, you'll know that in several different areas, the Quran is very specific about who they address. In one area, they say, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, talking to us, inshallah, the mu'mins. In one area it says, Ya Bani Adam, O children of Adam, which includes who? Everybody. In one area it says, Ya Ahlul Kitab, just those people who are Jews and Christians. In one area it says, Ya Ayyuhan Nas, O people. And so Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi in his book, Amuzish Aqaid, talks and uses this one proof. When he talks about the universality of the religion, he goes to the Quran and says, in our books, Allah does not specify one group of people. His message is for everybody. It's for people, the children of Adam, those who believe, those who don't believe Islam, but are still part of the other Abrahamic religions. So this differing across the board in the Quran is giving light to the fact that Islam came about for a universal message. Because the number one debate that these modernists have is that religion and Islam was for a one zaman, or one time, one culture, one language, one individual. Quran is saying that not the case at all. The other problem that we have with this modernism view of nowadays is that they don't understand that Islam's structure is structured such that as society changes, Islam equally fits that change. If we look at the life of some of the prophets, we understand one complete reality. And that is what? That is that it took 124,000 prophets to get the ummah to a level where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala perfected the religion through the last prophet of his. Al-yawm akmaltu lakum dinakum wa atmamtu ma'alaykum ni'mati. Famous ayat. Didn't come till when? Ghadir. When he announced the wilayat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, at that moment he saw that announcement as the perfection of the deen. Now the question a lot of our youth have is, how come that didn't happen in Nabi Yusuf's time, or Nabi Ibrahim's time, or Nabi Musa's time? And it's not that, na'udhu billah, that Islam changed. It didn't change. It simply adopted to the zarfiyat of the ummah, the capacity of the ummah. The people during Nabi Ibrahim's time were so stuck on worshipping planets, that how can you ask them to worship Allah, and that too five times a day? You first have to convince them for centuries that, look, this sun that you worship is going to set in a couple of hours. Believe in Allah that is one. When Nabi Yunus and his time in Babylon talked about this idea that, look, you're going to have an extreme punishment if you don't accept what I'm telling you. And then he left, and then they saw the asad and the effects of a punishment. And so they went up on the mountains and they prayed to Allah. Because these were people who saw Nabi Nuh's people and Nabi Lut's people and saw the azab on them. And right away they said, okay, fine, we believe in Allah. It took them to be threatened and then accept Allah. After that, worshipping Allah, ibadat, all these things was way out of the picture. They weren't ready for it. So slowly, you built the ummah's zarfiyat capacity to a point where the Holy Prophet comes across 23 years and perfects the religion. So the laws of Islam conform to the capacity of the people. Equally in today's days, today, 2011, we have a science called usul al-fiqh in Islam. There are some issues that happen today in this day and age that didn't happen in the Prophet's time, as many of you know. Right? Like these x-ray scanners in the airport, that nowadays they show, you know, your complete figure. The question is, are we allowed, fiqhi rulings, are we allowed to enter this or not? Are we allowed to go through this or not? I mean, for example, this of course didn't happen in the Prophet's time. So what Islam's beauty, and specifically the maktab of the Ahlul Bayt, what they did was they introduced this science that you have certain policies that you apply to derive rulings for that time and that time alone, making Islam a very modern and today religion. So this idea that there was one set of rules for every single ummah is wrong. Islam's beauty is it spoke to your capacity. And today, in this day and age, there are several of you, and myself included, that take different things from the religion. You know, the example that's often given is a buffet table, right? We have these restaurants that all you can eat for $7.99, right? Or you take your wife on her first anniversary there, because you're a romantic guy. So you spend $8 on your wife, mashallah. And so you go there and, you know, there's a big spread, mashallah, all sorts of stuff, and there's salad and there's fruits, and you leave that alone, you go straight to the meat, and, you know, and you pick out what you like. And you go back and you eat. And when you're hungry, you go back and you fill up those things that you like. Right? We do the same thing with Islam. Islam to us is a buffet table. We take what we like and we leave what we don't like. Right? If one of you were to get up and get out of this room and every 10 minutes come in and out, in and out, in and out, every 10 minutes, eventually one of you say, look, either you're in or you're out. Islam says the same thing, either you're in or you're out. Either you submit completely to what Allah says or you don't submit. But if you're going to say, La ilaha illallah, you're in now. There's no buffet tables here. You pick and choose what you like. You're in, submit completely. And I mentioned yesterday one of the ideas of conviction, because conviction is the solution to fight these modernist views that we have nowadays, that will convince all of you that your Islam is outdated. Your Islam is prehistoric. Really, you believe in a religion that covers your women? Really? That allows your wife to have one husband and you can have three other wives? That's not barbaric. That's not caveman era. And unless you have conviction in your religion, you're going to shake. And they will completely pull you off the path. So I mentioned yesterday, conviction does not come without submission. We have this movement right now amongst the youth that we want to be convinced first, and then we'll submit. Islam says, no, submit, and then the doors of conviction will open. Al-Islam huwa al-taslim, wal-taslim huwa al-yaqeen. Not the other way around. Islam is submission, submission is conviction. So if you are dying for conviction, which I know all of you are, and some things don't make sense to me. Look, I understand hijab, I know the sleeves, I know the loose clothing, but socks? Really? And so we'll do everything, we won't wear socks. 98% of hijab is perfect, for that 2%, our ego won't allow us to do that 2%. Because I don't get it. You're nobody to understand what Allah's rulings are. You are limited. I am limited. To try to understand that lah madud, your aql is not enough, I'm sorry. If you've submitted, if you're in, then stay in. But this idea of in and out and buffet style, pick what you want, leave what you want, Islam says no. And that's the problem with our youth today, the problem with all of us. There are some things that are so attractive in Islam that we just want those things. And some things that are very difficult, especially in the West. You want to make a business deal, there's a female in front of you, you know that if you don't shake her hand, that deal could be broken. So you shake her hand. You know that if you don't go drinking on Friday nights with the boys where your boss is there, you might lose out on a big promotion. So you go to the bar. And you think, I know Islam doesn't want me to lose my job, so I'll sit there at the bar and have a drink. You'll have orange juice, but you'll sit there. These things, there's no compromise in them. So I understand that these things are difficult. Islam understands as well. But once you've submitted, you're in completely. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So we're trying to battle this ever-growing debate that whether or not Islam is modern or not. First of all, I mentioned yesterday, and we really have to understand this for a moment, that Islam is based on the fitrat of the insan, on the intrinsic nature of man. It came about talking about and talking to your intrinsic nature. And the laws of nature don't change, we know that. Wherever there is a human, the laws of nature exist. Wherever you have a mother, the love that she'll have for a child exists. It's not that the love exists for mothers in North America and don't exist for mothers in Europe. It's not that we have this need to worship in North America and the need to worship in Asia doesn't exist. Islam was built on the fitrat. Islam was built on the intrinsic nature of man. And Allama Tabatabai says that because that's built on laws of nature, and nature does not change, thus Islam can never be outdated or prehistoric. The problem lies in our application of the deen today. That's where these people have a problem. Because they've chosen a lifestyle, I mentioned yesterday, they've chosen a lifestyle. You know, this Irshad Manji character who's chosen a lifestyle, right? She has her partner and she's living her life like that. And she, you know, confesses it, that this is my lifestyle. And now because she knows that what she's doing is wrong, she can either accept what I'm doing is wrong and ask for tawbah from Allah, or you can take on the entire system of the deen just to justify your disgusting lifestyle. And that's what a lot of us do, I mentioned yesterday. And that's the problem with these individuals. And sometimes the anti-Islamic movement will come and grab a Muslim like the Irshad Manjis, feed them money, give them fame, give them fortune, and completely misguide our youth. And a lot of our youth are buying it. And like the brother said yesterday, those who are not here, the ones I should be talking to, and you're right. But a lot of your friends, a lot of our friends, are those who have detached themselves from Islam, detached themselves from the community. And let me just say one thing in brackets here, if I can. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. There's a lot of... You guys are with me tonight, inshallah? It's a little bit of a heavy discussion, but enough ulama have come through this place. I don't need to sit there and tell you to pray namaz and be a good person and fast and give khums. You guys have heard that 1,000 times. Let's go up one notch, do our best to discuss the real issues here in the West. Why it's so difficult for our youth to reach that level of certainty. There are anchors upon anchors pulling us down in the West. You know, there's shaitan upon shaitan. Every door you open, every corner you turn, every time you flip the TV on, every time you log on your text phone, everything, there's shaitan everywhere. In brackets, I'm going to tell you that from my experience now, I'm not talking about books, I'm talking about my own experience. Your salvation is this community, or a community of some sort. And I ask you, I plead with you, don't detach yourself from this community. You'll travel enough to know, and again, it's not my topic, but you'll travel enough, and if you've seen other centers and other communities, you'll know that what you have here in the Bay Area is a blessing. It really is. And sometimes, like a fish out of water, we don't understand the blessing we have until we've left that community. I've traveled enough, and I shared some stories last night with some of the brothers, where I know that there are some communities that are hurting out there, and some that, mashallah, are booming and ever-changing and reforming. And this community, mashallah, is one that you can really gain from. And yes, you can tell me 1,000 issues with this community. I can tell you 1,000 ones about my community. As my father-in-law would say, where you have a couple of dishes, there's bound to be noise, he says. Same idea. And especially in this community, you have, mashallah, 4 cultures. And the fact that you guys haven't killed each other yet is a mojiza, if you ask me. Salawat on that, yeah. The point is that, of course, it goes back to leadership and the alim, as Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, Allah would say, that if you see a community that is detrimental and that's falling, look at its leader. And if you see a progressive community, look at its leader. And so, same idea. I know you guys are busy. I know a lot of you have just graduated. You guys are entering university. You guys are trying to get married. Some of you have moved away. Some of you are, you know, working and you're going to school, etc. Do your best to at least allow your nafs to taste the pleasure of a community once in a while. Because the one thing I don't like about this community is the involvement of the youth, with all due respect. I've come here enough where I can be blunt with all of you, and you know that I'm coming from love. The Sabah youth should be more involved, and you guys should be more out there than you are. Because right now, I'm telling you, there are big anti-Islam movements in the West. And some of you may have tasted it, and others have not. If you don't have the right tools in your pocket, guys, you'll be pulled off the path very easily. Because fitna and fasad is growing in our communities, internally, externally. There are millions of dollars being spent to pull you off the path, pull you out of the masjids. We've lost generations upon generations because of this reason. So I ask you, attach yourself to the community. I'm not saying to ignore your academics. I'm not saying to ignore your family life. I'm saying to manage your time. You know, there was this story that I told in Toronto during the first Ashura, a very famous one. Of course, I know you've heard it before. That this professor of philosophy enters his classroom, doesn't say a single word, and places an empty jar of mayonnaise in there. Classic story. Opens the jar up, places about 6 or 7 golf balls in the jar, closes it, and then asks the group, "Is this jar full?" The class says, "Yes." Again, doesn't say a word, opens the jar, goes in his bag, pulls out a bag of pebbles, pours it in where the golf balls are not, the pebbles are, closes it, and asks the class again, "Is this jar full?" They say yes again, opens it up, pulls out a bag of sand, pours the sand in there. And again, wherever the pebbles and golf balls are not, it reaches, closes the jar, again asks this class that's very slow apparently, "Is this jar full?" Again, they say yes. Opens the jar, pours a cup of coffee in the jar, closes it, and says, "This is your life." Where the golf balls are the things that are the most important to you, those things that without you can't live. Your Allah, your spouse, your family, your children, your health, your community. The pebbles are those things that are important, yes, but if you don't have them, your life is not going to end. Your car, your cell phone, your job, all these things. And the sand is everything else. He says, had I reversed the order where I first put the sand and then the pebbles and then the golf balls in, like we do in our life sometimes, we would have no time and we have no room for the golf balls. The golf balls wouldn't fit. Then finally, after that whole lecture, someone asked him, "What does a cup of coffee represent?" He says, no matter how busy life is or how full life is, there's always time for a cup of coffee. Right? Ask yourself, what are your golf balls? And have we first entered that into our life? Or are we stuck on the sand and the pebbles that just mean nothing to us, with all due respect? Do we have time for ourselves? Do we have time for our Lord? Do we have time for our families, our friends, our community? Or are we stuck on the pebbles and the sand right now? Anyways, the idea is to manage your time properly. Don't detach yourself from the community. Because one thing that you can fight when it comes to this fitna and facade and this disturbance that's happening socially is to attach yourself to your deen. And part of that process is to attach yourself to some center. I'm not saying come to Sabah. If you're close to Fatimiya, if you're close to somewhere else, if you're from out of town, whatever the case may be, make sure that you have some attachment to the community. Not that, you know, for 6 months now, no one has any idea where you are. Once in a while, pop your head in, remember Allah, and then go back out to your real life, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Because we'll look at later on, we'll talk a little bit about this idea of insight and basirat. We look at history, and then we'll move towards Masaib, inshallah. We'll look at history, and I'll tell you, if you're not able to distinguish between truth and falsehood, because right now this modernist movement is reeking of falsehood. It's a cop-out, if you ask me, for those Muslims who didn't have the courage to follow Islam. They're simply justifying their life by challenging the deen of Islam, with all due respect. And so, we look at the War of Siffin, for example. I know history is dry, but let's apply, extract the lessons from the War of Siffin to see exactly the effects of the lack of a criteria between haq and batil. I don't have time to read the whole war. Of course, as many of you know, when Mawla Ali with his army of 40,000 people were minutes away from destroying Muawiyah's army of 100,000 people, this individual who was very tactful placed Quran on spears, as all of you have heard many times, and said that we want the Quran to arbitrate between us. You know, when Amir al-Mu'mineen took over the Khilafat, the first thing he did was he removed all of the governors that Osman and Umar had in their Khilafat. And Muawiyah was very scared of losing Syria. So this war happened. So when people saw the Quran on spears, and on one side they saw Ali, on one side they saw the Quran, they were very confused, naturally. And those who were around Mawla Ali turned to him and said, "Are we fighting you? Are we fighting the Quran?" And Mawla says, "Look, understand what haq is, and then know what he's doing. I see pieces of paper on a spear. If you want to understand what Quran is, I'm not Quran Nathik. I am that speaking Quran. I am that haq. Understand who I am, and then know his propaganda." They wouldn't buy it. They surrounded him. People of his own army. To the point where he had to call Malik Ashtar and say, "Malik, come back." Malik says, "Look, Mawla, give me 5 minutes. This war is over. Trust me." He says, "Malik, in 5 minutes, your Mawla won't be alive." He was forced to come back. This group that surrounded itself around Mawla Ali and eventually separated from Mawla Ali were known as the Kharijites, or the Khawarij, as they say. And these were individuals who gave bayat to Amir al-Mu'mineen al-Ghadir. You know, Ibn Mujim, who struck Mawla Ali, who was the Qatil of Amir al-Mu'mineen, was a Khariji. A man who gave bayat, put his hand in the hand of Mawla Ali on the day of Ghadir. He was part of these individuals who couldn't distinguish between truth and falsehood, so they extracted themselves. They didn't accept Muawiyah, they didn't accept Ali either. And so this group started this practice called takfir. Follow me for a second, please. I'm ending this and then inshallah towards Masaib. What is takfir? Takfir is to label Muslims as kafirs. They had this extreme view. If you didn't follow the extreme view, you were a hypocrite, and so you were a kafir. So they believed that Mawla Ali, how can you arbitrate and negotiate with Muawiyah when this khilafat is given to you by Allah? How can you negotiate something given by Allah? The same people who question Imam Hassan Sul with Muawiyah. Our own Shias questioned that. They na'udhu billah, sold out to Muawiyah. 95% of Imam Hassan's army turned their back on him. Where is he going to fight Muawiyah? Anyways, this group separated now, started this trend of doing takfir. And today, my brothers and my sisters, today in this day and age, we have a very supreme, extreme group in Islam called the takfiris. And these takfiris do what? They label us as Shias kafir. In the walls of Pakistan, they'll label Shia kafir, Shia kafir. On YouTube, you find these videos of our ulama reading Masayib, let's say, of Abu Abdullah, and the label of the video is something disrespectful towards the Shia alim. If you trace this extremist group, in fact, if you look at all the problems Islam has today, and this extremist view, where they have videos online of these individuals who have masks on and la ilaha illallah, and then they're cutting off heads. It's not what Islam is, and you and I know that it's not what Islam is. They kill the bodies, they hang them from bridges, they burn the bodies, they drag them through the streets, they beat them with sticks. That's not who we are. That's not what Islam is, but this group now in the name of Islam does this. They're extreme groups. And part of that extreme group are the Takfiris, who label you and I as kafirs because we're not extreme in their views. If you trace back the nasl generations of this Takfiri group that today is causing all the problems, it starts off from that group in Siffin that broke off from Amir al-Mu'mineen. One instance of not being able to distinguish between Haq and Batil, between Muawiyah and Ali, resulted in this group today that exists. The issue at hand is very dire, my brothers and sisters. You guys can walk around with your eyes closed and not be aware. You can wake up for a moment, look around you and see what's going on right now. And I'm not talking about conspiracy theories. I'm not into conspiracy theories. I'm not into the Illuminati and the arrivals and all that. I'm not. We're talking about actual real mind control being done by this society. And this society's mind control starts off by attacking your identity. Making you feel like you are less than everybody else, making you feel like you're one of those, they'll tell you. They'll tell our sisters who wear proper hijab, mashallah, you're imprisoned, you're oppressed, free yourself from the jail. And thus we see after 9/11, the amount of hijabs that come off, mashallah, are increasing. Because they have convinced our sisters that, look, your life will get better. You'll find that Prince Charming if your hijab comes off. And so this issue is very, very dire. If we don't have that basirat, we'll talk about that in a couple of days, then we can be easily pulled off the path. Because the reality is that we're all preparing for the Imam to arrive, right? That's what our whole mission is. That's why we're doing this commemoration. That's why we come every Thursday. That's why we fly in people from all sorts of different cities. It's to somehow get us going in terms of the arrival of the Imam. And something I mentioned in today's khutbah during Salatul Jum'ah, I said that the companions that Imam Hussein had were unlike any other companions. Not Rasulullah, not Mawla Ali, not Imam Hassan. Nobody had the companions that Imam Hussein had. And you've heard it a thousand times. But where in our books there is a comparison of the companions with Imam Hussein are those companions that will stand beside our 12th Imam. And those, inshallah, will be you and I. At least you, inshallah. So if we want to understand at what level we should be at, let's look at the companions of Imam Hussein. These were individuals that weren't ordinary individuals. Right? Zuhair ibn Qayn, for example. There are many examples who are sitting there in front of Imam Hussein. And Imam Hussein, very famous, he says, look, their war is with me, not with you. They want my blood. They don't want you. Go. You're free to go. Go back to your lives. Go back to looking after your families. Heaven is yours. I've given you Jannat. Can you imagine for a moment how many of us will take off at that moment? Blows out the candle, very famously, relights it, nobody leaves. 30,000 on one side, 72 on another. Historically, have you ever heard no one leaving that army? In fact, we hear the opposite of Hur and his slave and his son coming over onto the side of Imam Hussein. Can you imagine? Historical war that we are commemorating every single year. And Zuhair ibn Qayn says to Imam Hussein, look at these words. He says, Mawla, if they were to kill me, trample my body, cut my body into pieces, give that body life, kill me again, trample me again, cut me again, give that body life, kill me, trample me, cut me 1,000 times, I wouldn't leave your side. Anas bin Harith was who? Anas bin Harith was a 93-year-old companion of Imam Hussein who was in Karbala. He was in his 90s, my brothers and sisters. His back was bent, his hair was white. Imam Hussein said, look, you don't have to fight. Islam is exempting you from this jihad. He says, I look at you, Hussein ibn Ali. I remember that time when you were sitting on the lap of your grandfather in the masjid. And Rasulullah kept kissing your neck time and time again. And we would wonder, why is Rasulullah kissing the neck of his four-year-old grandson? At that moment, he looks out to the crowd. He says, Husaynu minni wa ana min al-Husayn. He explains to Anas that, Anas, my grandson will be killed on the plains of Karbala. If you are alive during those days, I ask you to be beside my grandson during those days. Yani one sentence that an alim wrote was a beautiful sentence. Those companions that were not obligated to fight in the way of Islam, meaning women, children, and the old, were there in Karbala beside Imam Hussein. One day, Ibn Hilal was also one of the companions of Imam Hussein. He comes out of the khaymah, the tent. He sees that Imam Hussein is walking around alone outside. He says, Ya Mawla, you're out here alone by yourself. What if the enemies attack? You should be more careful. He says, Ibn Halal, you see those mountains in the distance? He says, yes, I see the mountains. Do you see that space between the mountains? He said, yes. He goes, I'm letting you go. He goes, you walk between the space in those mountains and you go live your life. You don't need to be here. And then Ibn Halal says that Mawla walked out towards the Maidan of Karbala and kept looking at different spots on the plains of Karbala. And when Ibn Halal asked him, Mawla, what are you doing? He said, I'm simply picturing where my family and my shuhada will fall from their horses in the different spots of the Maidan of Karbala. Can you imagine what Imam Hussein saw? That this is where my owner Muhammad will fall. That this is where my Qasim's body will be trampled. This is where my Akbar will cry that there is pain in my chest from that barchi in the chest. That this is where my Abbas's right arm will fall. This is where my Abbas's left arm will fall. This is where my Ali Asghar will be laid on the plains of Karbala, opening his mouth and closing his mouth, simply asking for a drop of water. But the greatest companion that Imam Hussein had was Habib ibn Mudahir. Imam Hussein wrote Habib a letter. This is where sometimes our sisters don't understand that the wives of these companions played a very crucial role as well. He's sitting at the dining table with his family. Habib is, there's a knock at his door. In walks the postman. He gives Habib the letter. Habib reads this letter. His face changes. His wife says, what is it, Habib? Habib said, it's a letter from my mullah. And the first thing that she says is, what are you waiting for, Habib? Your mullah is calling you, go. She knows full well what's going to happen to her husband, but never once does she think about what's going to happen to me. I'm going to be widowed. My children will be orphaned. No, she says, your mullah is calling you and you're not going. Go. When Habib arrives in Karbala, they say Imam Hussein was very serious. He never smiled once, but when he saw Habib, for a moment he smiled. He says, my Habib is here now. This was the same Habib that when he gave his life in Karbala, my brothers and my sisters, when his head was severed from his body, these mal'uns, these animals, tied the head of Habib to a horse and they would parade his horse back and forth, dragging the head of Habib against the sand. After Sham-e Ghariba, when all the heads were on spears, this individual kept tying the head of Habib against the horse and kept dragging his head against the sand. one individual says, "Oh, rider of the horse, why don't you just bury that head? Why do you keep dragging it from here to here, from there to there?" At that moment, a voice comes from Habib's head that says, "Don't you dare bury my head when my Hussein's head is still on a spear. If you want to bury anyone's head, you bury my Mullah's head first, and then you bury my head." سَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to accept this qaleel ibadat inshallah. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us tawfiq to understand the true mission of Imam Hussein inshallah. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that in the hearts of our youth to convert the pleasure of sin to the pleasure of worship inshallah. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In the world there's so much bloodshed, injustice and tyranny. The only solution that we see is the coming of the 12th Imam. We ask you, Allah, to hasten that reappearance and make us companions and soldiers beside him in his mission, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.